This is Report to Wyoming.
A Casper woman is among the first of graduates in the world to earn a Master of Arts in Happiness. Diane Martin graduated the same month she retired in May of 2024. The topic of happiness has captured a lot of attention recently. What it is, why it's important, and how we can obtain a piece of it. For this discussion, I sit down with Diane, and we phone in her professor, Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar, to learn more about the course and what it has taught the born and raised Wyoming girl. How did you end up at Centenary? Is that how you say it? Or Centenary?
Centenary.
Centenary University in Hackettstown, New Jersey.
You know, for many years, I was looking for a partner university where I could help create a master's degree in happiness studies. And time after time, I was turned down by universities around the world on account of this being a there not being a precedent in terms of wanting to do psychology rather than happiness studies. And then I arrived by happenstance at Centenary, and there the question that they asked me was, how soon can we start? So what I found was a flexible, open, nimble university that was prepared to do something that hadn't been done before.
Where do you start when you get there?
Well, first of all, we need to go through the accreditation process, which is not an easy one. And again, not easy because there are no precedents. So we went through that, and we created and we designed the structure. And as soon as it was approved, within 3 months, actually, we had our first cohort starting.
Was this in the fall of 2023?
In the fall of 2022.
Okay, so have you had two, or should I say four, classes go through these studies?
But we had one class that graduated because the degree is 2 years long. So one class just graduated, and we have two additional classes now participating in the program.
And it looks like that graduating class was 87 students from 13 countries. Wow. What do you think about that?
Needless to say, I'm thrilled. Though I must say that I wasn't surprised. And in fact, I'm expecting the numbers to grow and the interest to grow. You see, there is a real need for a master's degree specifically, but more generally for the field of happiness studies. So the fact that there is interest from many people from different countries, I think we're only seeing the beginning of this.
Now, the pushback would be that maybe happiness studies is selfish, hedonistic. Some people have even said the point of life is to suffer, not that happiness and suffering can't go hand in hand. How do you meet with those kinds of thoughts?
So first of all, they're very important ideas, because you see, happiness has received a bad reputation, and some of it was well-deserved. Because people who talk about happiness often essentially are talking about pleasure. So the way we use the concept is in, for example, in this context, oh, I was so happy I went to the beach, or I had an ice cream, and you know that made me so happy. You know, that's not happiness, that's pleasure. A happy life is one that also includes suffering and difficulties and hardships and a sense of meaning and purpose and relationships and intellectual development. So happiness, as I see it, and as we teach it, of course, is a much broader concept that is more about the, or closer to the way the ancient Greeks or the ancient Chinese looked at happiness, which was about a full and fulfilling life, about flourishing, rather than merely about pleasure.
So you mean that there isn't a pill I can take?
You know, I wish there were easy fixes, but from the research that I know and the experiences that I've had, there are no shortcuts. It takes work. It takes effort.
I definitely want to get into that, but really quickly, Diane, I just wanted to ask how a woman from Casper, Wyoming, comes across this program.
Yeah, about 5 years ago, I started taking self-development programs online. I was just looking for a way of excelling at happiness, and I learned that what I was really looking for was a whole person well-being mindset, more than just your passing happiness kind of things that people generally talk about. And as I was doing those programs, I ran, the primary one was one called Heroic, where I learned about Dr. Ben Shahar's books, Happier and The Pursuit of Perfect. He's written many. And I became so interested in that material that I was looking at what other offerings he had and was looking at the certificate program. And lo and behold, I attended a little intro thing that he had on the college master's degree. And by the end of that meeting, I had signed up. I'd contacted UW and transferred my records. And at the end of the thing, I just said to myself, wow, how am I going to pay for this now? But it was just so perfectly fit with all the other things that I'd been learning. I knew it was the next thing I needed to do.
And happiness is so personal. Did you find it was difficult to take yourself out of the studies and think about happiness as a thing, not just something that you might desire?
You know, as I was going through the course, I think my primary focus was on myself, because I think that's where it starts. But as the course has continued, and especially since graduation, I've started to see it from another perspective. I look at other people now and I say, what can I do to help them be happier? I made block parties for my block and brought all of my neighbors together. And we all know each other now and visit with each other and say hello. And I've started looking in other places and saying, how can my information help other people be happier? So it's only been recently that I've started looking outward and expanding this bubble of happiness that I have, because I did start the program looking inward and saying, how can I excel at my own happiness? And then that has just graduated, like I graduated, it's graduated to other people.
During your studies, what was one thing that you found maybe surprising or unexpected?
I think the ancient philosophers, probably. I had had a hard time reading that material in the past, and I really just didn't connect with them. And then working through that material in this program, I really started to connect with what they were saying and the world that they were living in and how much alike it was to my world. Until then, they lived planets away in my mind. But I started to really connect with that, and I think that was my biggest surprise, was how much I had in common with ancient philosophers who lived thousands of years ago, and how much what they had to say back then still applied to the world today and to my life.
I'm excited to hear more about that as well. Dr. Tall, I wonder how can anyone attain happiness? And let me couch this with by saying, you know, a lot of us, especially when your life is starting out, or maybe you're 30, 40, and you're looking to the future, a lot of us go, I'll be happy when I get this thing, when I've achieved this goal. How do people start thinking about being happy now?
You know, if you think about happiness, there are essentially two dominant schools of thought. One school of thought, mostly associated with the West, is that I'll be happy when. In other words, when I get this job, or when I make so much money, or when I get into a relationship or this relationship, then I'll be happy. In other words, it's happiness that is focused on some future achievement and attainment. The other school of thought, mostly associated with Eastern philosophy and psychology, is about the present moment. Now, you can't really find happiness in the future. Find it in the journey, in the here and now. And both schools prescribe different ways, of course, of attaining happiness. One is, you know, work really hard so that you can make it. Or the second school, just meditate, just be present. Now, it turns out that happiness is actually about the synthesis of the two. You see, we are future-oriented as well. We do want to achieve things. We do want to improve, and there's nothing wrong with that. At the same time, the achievement in and of itself does not yield happiness. And we know that from so many people who have achieved their goals, whether becoming famous or rich or successful or winning this this tournament or achieving this goal, the happiness that they experience is at best temporary. So the achievement in and of itself does not lead to happiness. At the same time, ignoring the future, discarding any focus on a goal is also not the solution and will not lead to happiness. What we need is to have goals and then realize that it's the journey, the process towards these goals that yields the most happiness. So it's not the achievement of the goal. In other words, the goal is not the end, but rather the striving towards the goal. In other words, the goal is the means. Having a goal is important. And then when we have the goal, we can focus on the journey, on the day-to-day.
You mentioned meditation. What other things can we do to get to that fusion of both things?
So first, identify things that are meaningful to us. You know, it's if it's meaningful to me to start a business, then great. If it's meaningful to me to write a book, then wonderful. If I find meaning in spending time with my loved ones, then that is, of course, important. And speaking of loved ones, the number one predictor of happiness is not going to come as a shocker. No big surprise here. Number one predictor of happiness is quality time we spend with people we care about and who care about us. Now, even though most people would probably connect to it value it and support it and promote it in their lives, that's not what they actually do. So spending quality time with loved ones means doing it when our phones are off and we're just focused on those people. Well, most people, and you know, you go to a restaurant today and you see so many people out there, you know, checking their emails while they're at a meal, not really being together. Or you find people foregoing their friends and family so that they can be more successful. Now, I'm not saying that there shouldn't be any sacrifice for the purpose of a goal that is meaningful to you. However, right now, most people are foregoing the most important sources of happiness in their lives. In other words, their relationships, friendships, families are not their top priority. And we as a society, we're paying a price for it.
And Diane, do you see when you sense that someone is unhappy, how do you think that affects you and everyone around them?
Well, just like happiness is contagious, so is unhappiness. You know, you've been in a room where someone comes in a really sour frame of mind and can instantly affect everyone in the room. You know, when I run into that, I like to use a tool that we learned in class, which was permission to be human. And in my own head, I say to myself, I'm giving that person permission to be human right now. something has happened to them, they are in a situation, they are exploding negativity, and I'm really compassionate for them in that moment. And I think that single change in my frame of mind is so helpful, because that person doesn't feel judged by me. I'm not jumping on their bandwagon. They just feel really accepted for being in the moment that they're in with me. And I think that's probably the most helpful tool that I've learned from this, is just allowing people to be in whatever situation they're in at any given moment, giving them permission to be human. It started with giving myself permission to be human and accepting that I go through those things, and then it became really easy to extend that to other people. I find that I'm just so much more compassionate and understanding of the situations they're in, and it stops me from going into that same space that they brought into the room. And I think it actually helps them come out of their negative space a little bit and pulls them a little bit more toward the positive.
Are there any other practices that you do to try to stay in a positive frame of mind?
I really find that meditation is so helpful to me, and I've narrowed it down to 22 minutes a day is my favorite amount of time, first thing in the morning with my cup of coffee sitting on my back porch. And it just starts the day off in the right frame of mind. And when I drift away from that for too many days in a row, I notice that I'm getting edgy. And so I tell myself, you know, let's get back to that early morning. It can even be just quiet time. It's not like official meditation in some guru position or anything like that. It's just that 22 minutes of breathing and focusing seems to set my whole day.
I relate to you too, because I try to wake up by 6:30 and have that 30 minutes to myself. If I'm going to meditate for 10 minutes, so be it. But there are so many distractions, especially cell phones, but also restaurants. Even other people can distract when you know you have an intention set and you also want to be a people pleaser. So you end up going to some party that you didn't necessarily want to go to, but you do a disservice to yourself in those instances, right? So how do you grapple with all the things of the world but staying true to yourself?
I think the first thing I realized is that my relationships were suffering before I went into the master's degree program, and I learned how important relationships are to my happiness and well-being. And I learned that if I'm going to be serious about pursuing my happiness and my well-being, then I need to be serious about pursuing relationships. And I need to put some effort into it, and I need to pay attention. And so my very favorite thing to do whenever I'm with other people is I leave my cell phone tucked away in my purse, out of sight, out of mind, and I ignore it completely, because I say to myself, my presence is a present. And amazingly, it started to rub off on my friends. They noticed, like, you don't have your phone out at lunchtime. And I'm like, no, I want to pay attention to you. I want this to be our time. And believe it or not, that has really rubbed off on family and friends, and they notice it and they have started to like it. Like, I wish I could leave my phone away. And I'm like, well, try it, you know, put it in your purse right now. And so that's just how I've done it, is I start with me and I say, what am I going to do? I'm going to go to that party. I'm going to be present. I'm going to put my phone away. I'm going to leave my distractions elsewhere. And I'm going to remind myself that these relationships that I could be creating right now are so important for my whole being, for my whole life. It's more than just this 5 minutes or this 10 minutes or this one party. And so I put work into relationships now that I never thought about before.
And Dr. Tall, is physical wellness a component of happiness?
Very much so. When we talk about happiness, we talk about five elements. We talk about spiritual well-being, physical well-being, intellectual, well-being, relational well-being, and finally, emotional well-being. These five elements make up the acronym SPIRE: spiritual, physical, intellectual, relational, and emotional. Now, under physical well-being, we're talking, for example, about physical exercise. We know from a lot of research that regular exercise, and that is as little as 30 minutes three times a week of an aerobic workout. It could be jogging or walking or swimming or playing ball or dancing, has the same effect on our psychological well-being as our most powerful psychiatric medication. In fact, it works in the same way. It releases norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine, you know, the feel-good chemicals in the brain. In addition, nutrition, of course, matters, as does sleep or more generally rest and recovery. So these are important elements of happiness. And if we neglect them, we pay a price.
I've even noticed myself and some of my peers starting to do things like moving the flat screen out or TV out of your bedroom because it's too distracting. Back to distractions. And so doing little things like you were talking about, Diane, putting the phone away. It's hard to retrain your brain, but knowing what the end goal is makes it a lot more doable, you know. I'm glad you brought up spirit. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, I would just like to also build on what Diane said about putting the phone away in your purse. You know, most people today, certainly in the U.S. and in the developed world, most people are addicted to their smartphones. And most people know it, and yet continue to go to bed when their smartphone is right next to them. Now, imagine an alternative scenario. Let's say, you know, you're an alcoholic addicted to alcohol. Would you go to bed, if you wanted to get rid of your alcoholism, would you go to bed with a bottle of whiskey right next to you? Of course not. You would keep that bottle away from you. And yet we go to bed with a phone next to us. You know, one of the things we do as a family, when we go to bed, we put the phone away so that the first thing in the morning when I open my eyes is, you know, I look at my wife and I meditate rather than immediately check my messages. It is so much healthier to start your day with meditation than it is with scrolling the news, which is, you know, usually bad news.
That's so true. And it's amazing what comes to mind when you don't get on your phone right away. After a good night's rest, those morning thoughts are surprising sometimes. Yeah. I'm glad you brought up spirituality. Not everybody practices a religion. What kinds of things do you do if you are not a religious person to tap into this? Is it acts of service, goodwill? What kind of things?
So the major elements of spiritual well-being are, one, a sense of meaning and purpose, and two, mindfulness and presence. So, you know, when Diane is talking about meditation, when we focus on the present moment, the here and now, we are cultivating our spiritual muscles. When I do something that is important, that is meaningful to me, and again, it could be running a business, it could be spending time with loved ones, it could be volunteering for a cause I deem worthy. These are all spiritual experiences. So yes, of course, we can experience spirituality in a house of worship. At the same time, we can also experience spirituality in basically anything that we do, if we bring presence and purpose to it.
And Diane, I wonder, on the spirituality subject, so many of us subconsciously are dreading about this life coming to an end, right? Mortality. How much do you think happiness plays a role in peace of mind?
In my mind, when I am in a happiness state, I have a peace of mind. I am calmer about things, not agitated, upset, or stressed out. And so it's even easier to think about death or negative things when your mind is in a calmer state of being. I was going to say, when you were talking about spirituality, that when I look at my spire elements, I consider my meditation time in the spiritual category. So I think I'm spending time every time I'm meditating in the S category, even though you wouldn't consider it religion, for example. So I just think it's easier to handle any kind of situation in life, especially the negative ones, with a calmer state of mental being than a frazzled, stressed out one. You know, it's a lot easier to handle a flat tire if you're calm, cool, and collected than if you're half an hour late for something and you've got two screaming kids in the back and nobody's had dinner and somebody needs a nap. You know, that's just like a recipe for chaos. And all of a sudden that flat tire becomes a nightmare for you versus a completely different scenario. A flat tire is just a flat tire, something that can be fixed. So it's just being more ready to deal with the stresses of the world when you're in a calmer state of mind.
And that reminds me of this, I think it's a Danish word. Have you heard of hygge? It's sort of this idea that you're going to enjoy the little things, live a simple life. Things like a nice cup of tea, fuzzy socks in the middle of winter, and really just saying no to the things that are distracting you from what's really important.
I had not heard of that word, but it reminds me of what I talked about already, was presence. It's really nice for me with my cup of coffee in the morning to really be present with my cup of coffee and enjoy that first sip, and especially on the colder fall mornings when I'm sitting outside, just smelling that smell in the air and being in the moment is another way of thinking about presence. And, you know, having a new pair of socks and just really enjoying them wholly for just a couple of seconds, right?
Right.
Appreciating the here and now instead of my mind being in my phone or my mind being in the television or my mind being someplace else. If my mind is just doing, if it's with me doing what I'm doing, then I'm appreciating that moment. And I think it's a bigger, fuller, more colorful, more alive life to be lived in the moment. And there's time for me to be thinking about all those other things when it's time to be thinking about them. But if I want to be appreciating this really cool new pair of swishy pants that I just bought, then let's focus on that. So it's just, I put my mind where I want it to be, paying attention to what I want it to be paying attention to.
I just envisioned a crackling fire and, you know, watching animals outside. That's so true. And how many times do we miss that? Because maybe we're dreading about something that's going to happen tomorrow, but being present. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Dr. Tall?
You know, what Diane is describing now through her meditation practice is her becoming more sensitive. More sensitive to nuances, and therefore more alive. Because when we become more sensitive, we appreciate every sensation, whether it's the sensation of the hot cup of coffee, whether it's the sensation of being present to the tree outside my window or the person sitting across from me. And we're not aware. We don't experience that sensation when we have our phone on and we're distracted or trying to fit in 20 things in that 1 hour. So it's when we focus, when we're mindful, that we become more sensitive, that we experience those sensations, and therefore, to be happy, we don't need the sensational. So the connection between sensitivity, sensation, and sensational is an important one. And that is also one of the misunderstandings of happiness, that we need something sensational, that we need our life to take, you know, a 180-degree turn in order for us to be happy, that we need something sensational, extraordinary. Whereas when we become sensitive and experience those subtle, nuanced sensations, then we can derive a great deal of happiness from the ordinary.
This has been Report to Wyoming, presented in the public interest by Town Square Media.